Hi, this is Bryant with something a little bit different than what we normally have on this podcast feed. This is a Socialism 101 class that I helped facilitate with a comrade named Jeremy for Denver DSA's Political Education Committee. I hope you find it educational, even if you've been involved with socialism for some time. Thanks to Jeremy and also Ben for helping put together the slideshow, Adam and Jacob for setting up the venue, and everyone else who showed up and participated. So I've bleeped the names of everyone else that was involved in the recording, just for the sake of privacy. I don't know if that's necessary, but I went ahead and did it. Apologies for the audio quality. It was recorded with just a microphone pointed at a speaker because I didn't have the right cable, but I hope it's at least intelligible. You can find a link for the slideshow in the show notes. So the slide deck that we had behind us while we were giving the lecture, and also a link to the Denver DSA calendar if you want to get involved locally. We're hoping to have more Socialism 101 events like this in the future, and we're also working on a 102 class that will happen sometime in the future whenever we get that done, that will go more into depth on socialist concepts and history. And also, if you'd like to be involved with political education, you can contact me via the Denver DSA Slack channel or email carsandcomrades@gmail.com, and I'll try my best to get you set up with all that. Thanks. Have a good one.
All right. So our first prompt here, Bryant, do you want to take this away?
Yeah. So we've got a smaller prompt. We're not going to break up into groups or anything, but I'll just bring the microphone to anyone that wants to speak, or you can just shout if you want. So just the idea is, like, what does a better world look for you? So, like, what is your vision of, not necessarily like the change or the revolution or anything, but like, what is the end goal of what we're doing here? What do you want? What improvements do you want to see in the world? Maybe it's people dancing around in a circle with the rainbow.
Or maybe they're concrete policies or aspects of society that you think should be fundamentally different than they are today.
Yeah. Anyone?
I don't have a policy on how to fix this, but I don't feel like we should have as much homelessness as we do with the amount of resources that our country has and produces.
Well said. Yeah, completely agree. Homelessness is a solvable problem, right? We know what it takes. It's not like it's some abstract concept, right? It's people need a place to sleep. People need a place to live. That is a fundamentally material problem that we can solve if we so choose. Anyone else? I'll go. I'll add one. So I work for the state of Colorado's Medicaid program. Our agency is called Healthcare Policy and Financing. Oh, no shit. Well, hey, nice. Co-wins, right? Cool. Good to see a fellow state employee in the house. Healthcare is one that's really deeply tied to my purpose for being a part of this organization and just socialism in general. We are the only industrialized nation on this planet, and to Brad's earlier point, we have so many great resources. How the hell do we not have universal coverage? Nothing makes me want to slam my head against my desk more than listening to politicians and policy leaders in this state talk about the uninsured rate when, again, that is a very solvable problem. It just takes the legwork, the effort, and dedication. So I appreciate you sharing, envisioning a better world. This, again, takes many shapes, colors, and flavors. So it can be all sorts of things, right? Things that we all want. And I think generally we're mostly agreed. I would take a guess that one of the things we all want to see as far as a better world is not bombing children, right? Anyhow, why we can't have nice things? So what are some of the biggest blocks preventing this better world and these policies from becoming reality? Anyone want to share?
I would say a lot of it is greed from the top 1% of people who accumulate all the wealth and do not share it with anyone else.
I think you're right about that. Any other thoughts? Yeah.
I think maybe on an interpersonal level, a large majority of people feel disempowered, and so there's kind of this lack of empathy and lack of belief that we can actually change.
Yeah, it's like a tiring effect almost, right?
Everything is so profit incentive based, like systems can't really exist unless they're profitable. So a lot of things that we need, we don't have the political desire to do because there's not a return on the investment in the way we'd like.
Perfect. I couldn't agree more. That goes right back to the homelessness issue. It goes right back to healthcare. You could extrapolate that and talk about childcare. You could talk about transportation. One of the reasons we don't have high-speed rail, right? Or we don't have a better interstate, intranational transit system is because it's not profitable, right? It doesn't make money for a small set of people. So I think you guys nailed it. I think those are many of the things that are impeding our progress. The other one I would add, and I'm surprised we didn't hear it, is a two-party system. You know, there is a lot of nuance in politics beyond just left and right. There's a lot more, and I've got more to say on that, and we'll get to it later.
I was just going to say, I mean, we put in the Biden and Trump there just to say, like, it's not so much that we need to get new people in office, different people with different ideas. It's more of a systemic thing, and that's what we're trying to show with this.
Right. Like, you may or may not be aware, but in many, many, many industrialized nations, Europe is a good example, parts of Asia are good examples too. There are more than just two political parties. It's not just, you know, Democrats and Republicans. Okay, quick vocabulary break. I don't think I want to read all these definitions off the slide, so maybe take a moment and read, and I'm going to turn it over to Brian.
Yeah, I mean, I can just read this real quick. So, I mean, capitalism is an economic political system in which countries, trade, and industry are controlled by private owners for profit, and that's the key that we're going to key in on here. And then liberalism is a political doctrine that takes protecting and enhancing the freedom of the individual to be the central problem of politics. And so think individual rights, individual property rights, also like just what you think of as liberal rights.
John Locke, Thomas Hobbes.
Yeah, you know, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, that kind of thing.
Your Johns and your Thomases, yeah. Jefferson, you know, yeah. Hancock, whoever else.
And then neoliberalism is a little bit of a squishy idea. It's come to mean, like, just anything that I don't like for a lot of people. But this is the definition that we came up with or that we found. I should also say that Ben helped, or I should say Ben made most of the slideshow. I helped a little bit. So we might go a little off script of what Ben intended with this, but he's not here, so whatever. So one example of neoliberalism that I like to point out is the 2008 bailout. So we had this big financial crisis. A lot of people were upside down on their mortgages. A lot of companies were failing. What did the federal government do? It bailed out those companies to keep the economy going, but didn't bail out the homeowners who were, you know, upside down on their mortgages. A lot of people ended up homeless or losing their houses. So that's kind of what the priorities are in neoliberalism. It's also a globalized system. So, like, think of outsourcing to China or other countries where, you know, it's capital can move across borders, but people cannot.
Yeah.
So,
I think a great example of this in real time, if you've been paying attention to any of the international news, is Bangladesh. Yeah. Most of your clothing is made in Bangladesh. Fast fashion, right, so to speak. And they're protesting. And hell, there's a revolution in Bangladesh right now. So it's a good example of what globalization has brought. There are certainly benefits to it. There are pros, of course. I mean, there are things that we take for granted or things that we enjoy as privileges because we're the extracting power, right, because of where we live. But there are obviously incredible negatives, incredible cons. And so neoliberalism as an economic policy, as the role that it has imposed upon governance, before we even talk about the World Trade Organization and the international banking system and fiat currencies and all that, it's important to recognize that neoliberalism isn't just a catch-all for things that we don't like. It is a specific set of policies and decisions, and it has real outcomes.
And one last thing I'll say is that I think, in my opinion, I think neoliberalism and this free flow of capital around the world ends up harming working people in all countries, whether they're the first world countries like America, the imperial core, whether they're third world countries like Bangladesh, where a lot of the manufacturing gets done.
Right. And so one of the things that we referenced, right, is the extractive nature of neoliberal policies, of capitalism generally. Take a moment to read this tweet and check out this meme. I don't think this will surprise anybody here. But how do billionaires get their wealth, right? It takes a lot of hard work. Hundreds of thousands of hard workers who make the produce the value that they then extract. And so Bangladesh is another good example of this, right? Or anywhere. All the things that are made in China is another good example of this, right? Mexico nationalized their lithium, right? And that was a real, there were talks about it, there was a real concern because it would reduce the ability of the exploiters of the global north to exploit the global south. That's why whenever a Middle Eastern country wants to nationalize its oil, for instance, the U.S. decides it's time to topple that government.
And the only thing I have to add is that the guy on the left, Jeremy, is one of the founding members of Denver DSA. So he's a cool guy. I think he moved to New York. And I don't know why it's crossed out, but that's the screenshot I could find of that tweet. So
it's a good tweet.
Yeah.
All right. Our third prompt here. Does liberalism solve our problems? So again, liberalism, protect and enhance the freedom of the individual. Neoliberalism, free market capitalism, it means reduced government control over industry. Pro-globalization and free trade and a reduction in union power. Thinking back to what's blocking our better world, how does liberalism and neoliberalism attempt to resolve these issues or remove these roadblocks? And take a moment to think about that.
And we are going through this a little quickly, so we're not going to take 15 minutes on it. So, yeah.
So, like, for homelessness, for example, I know Governor Polis keeps talking about just giving tax breaks to people's mortgages, which, in theory, I guess, reduces house payments, but that doesn't really solve the problem of homelessness.
Doesn't help renters, does it?
Not at all.
Yep. That's a good point. I think the primary takeaway here is that neoliberalism and liberalism generally doesn't solve those problems, right? As much as they may seek to advance or seek to place a Band-Aid on, there is no meaningful resolution to those, right? Again, we talked about homelessness. That is a solvable problem. We know what it takes to get rid of it. It's just a matter of will. Another example I would even give is unemployment. You know, if you're familiar with macroeconomics, there is this concept of full employment, which is 0% unemployment rate, right? That is an achievable goal. The question of how to achieve it, the means of achieving it, that's up for debate, that's up for conversation. It would likely involve some sort of federal jobs program, similar to what we had during the New Deal, if you're familiar with the Tennessee Valley Authority and some of the other agencies that were created then.
Yeah, that might be something we go into more in like the 102 class or whatever, but I mean, there is like the concept of the Reserve Army of Labor. If you're curious, you know, look at that. Capitalism kind of relies on a certain number of people being unemployed to drive wages down, basically.
Yep. Yeah, well said, Brian. Thank you. Any final thoughts on this slide before we move forward? Yeah.
I guess their attempt is to pretty much place your success or your survival is all based on the individual. It's basically your fault if you're poor. So it places all the responsibility on the individual and it keeps everybody else divided.
And what are some of the upshot effects of that? Like what does that emphasis on the individual mean for society at large or for communities in general?
Well, then it makes people think that if you're doing okay, then it's not your problem if these people are unhoused. So you don't have to worry about it, and you just have to worry about yourself. And yeah, it places the burden on you rather than the government or the collective or the community.
Well said. Absolutely.
And I'll just add, like, this kind of attitude I see a lot with, like, well-meaning liberals who, especially if they're thinking of, like, people in the rural South, they'll think those people are, you know, poor, ignorant, backwards, kind of like what J.D. Vance was saying in his book, you know, and it's their fault that they didn't succeed, they didn't become whatever he was, a hedge fund broker.
Venture tech capitalists.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, I see that attitude a lot, especially with liberals from the North or from Colorado or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Okay, some of capitalism's contradictions. I think we talked about this, right? But bosses need to pay their workers as little as possible. Workers need to make as much as possible. And the system needs workers to spend as much as possible, right? Like our system, I will never forget this. I'm old enough to remember in the wake of 9/11, George Bush went on TV and basically said, thank you guys so much for getting the pizza.
We got pizza if you guys want to take a minute to go grab some.
He didn't say thank you for getting the pizza, but he did say, if you are, you know, spend. That was his message in, like, October. It was spend your money because the stock market took a dip. And the money powers were concerned that, you know, their system wasn't going to work as much as well as it should. You can only spend so much, right? I mean, we all know you have a household budget. You have to live within your means. That's a very different situation, especially when bosses are restricting pay constantly. That is their goal, is profit, right? I mean, the whole end game of any business enterprise is to make as much money for the shareholders as possible. The second contradiction, a commodity's use value is simply its usefulness. Its exchange value is its market price. Under a capitalist mode of production, commodities are produced solely for their exchange values to be sold for profits, not for usefulness, right?
And so, I mean, this is another concept that we'll probably go into more depth later in another upcoming class, but I think one good example of this is you see a lot more SUVs on the road today. And that's not necessarily because people want to buy SUVs. A lot of people would rather have a hatchback or a sedan or what have you. But it's more profitable for the car companies to sell SUVs because of they fit in through some government loopholes, et cetera. So that's what they end up building or making, I should say.
Profit motives neither include sustainability nor environmental impact. And again, I'm just going to go back to macroeconomics really quickly, but a great example of this is, how do you calculate GDP? Does anybody know what the general formulation is? The gist is GDP is how much your economy is producing, right? How much it's producing, how much value is in what's being produced. In no way do any major economic indicators include things like environmental impact, sustainability, or even things that are maybe subjective, like community benefit. I mean, again, let's talk about transportation really quickly. We don't have a robust transportation system, even in cities in the United States, in most cities, because it doesn't provide enough profit. It doesn't provide enough value to the shareholders of that industry. It's left, actually, to the local, state, or federal governments to do something with, but because neoliberalism reduces government influence, government control, government influence on the market, they lack the funds, they lack the resources to provide this stuff for free or at a much reduced premium. Brian, do you want to take the last one?
So capitalism requires constant expansion to fuel itself. So basically, the most profitable sectors of capitalism are on the frontiers where they're exploiting new markets, where a company can get in there first and be, the first. There's a term for it.
There's a term for it.
The first mover advantage, I think, is what it's called.
Yeah.
So, like, think of how Google got in basically ahead of all these other search engine companies. They kind of established themselves. They almost became a monopoly. I mean,
they did.
They're being prosecuted in several of their jurisdictions as a monopoly.
Yeah.
And now if someone else wanted to come in and start their own search engine or email thing, they'd have a much more difficult time doing that.
Cracking that in. So, and I want to add a couple things to this, too. One, capitalism's goal is infinite growth. right? That's like what it, that's, it will always become in the end a monopoly, right? Because the idea is that you box out anything that's smaller than you, you absorb. I mean, think about private equity. Private equity is buying up BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard. They own a portfolio that contains just about every company you could possibly imagine, right? I mean, and if you just look at a single industry, the goal of any capitalist company organization is going to be the biggest, to box out the rest, or to own all the others, so that you are the recipient of all of the profit, all of the value for those goods or services.
And there's another concept that we'll probably get into a later class called the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. That's basically as long as you're in a competitive market, firms competing against each other will drive down the prices of their goods so that basically no one's making profit at the end. So that's why firms want to become monopolies.
I was just going to say, it reminds me of like a cancerous tumor.
Took the words out of my mouth. That was the next thing I was going to say. I want you to think about capitalism as a cancer, right? What would you call something that consumes and grows indefinitely? Cancerous, right? Awesome. Let's move forward. Yeah.
Can you just clarify the one where it says commodities are produced solely for their exchange values? Is that saying that things are, the value is based on how much money you can make, not actually based on its usefulness? Is that?
Yeah, pretty much. And like a real life example, this is the, what's the term? You know how every product you own breaks down? Thank you. Planned obsolescence. I have a good friend, she works for Apple. We had a nice long debate about this once because I was like, you know, you're an engineer. It would be really great, I think, if you put your knowledge and talents to building something that didn't break every 12 months and was $800 or whatever the case is, right? That planned obsolescence is part of this because you know, your car is a depreciating value the moment you drive it off the lot if you buy it new, right? Why would you spend so much money on that if you know it's just going to break down? Its usefulness, right, is not in consideration. The only consideration is how much can I sell it for? What is this worth to me in terms of the profit I can make? Or if I were a company, much the same, right? I enjoy watching Shark Tank, I'll be honest with you. I think it's kind of funny. But that's one of the questions they always ask, right? Is what are your margins? How much does it cost you to produce this product? And how much do you sell it for? And if your margins aren't good enough, Kevin O'Leary's gonna laugh at you and you're not gonna get a deal. All right.
So I think we'll just maybe take a 5-minute break because we're a little stretched on time. So yeah, think about these contradictions and like, you know, what we can do to change them. Go ahead and take some pizza, use the bathroom, whatever you gotta do.
Yeah.
And we'll be back, let's see, what time is it now?
5 minutes later.
How we doing? Everybody doing good? Any thoughts, questions? Things you're thinking about? Things you wish we would have talked about so far? No. Everybody's really knowledgeable and happy. Good. So on the next slide, we're gonna talk a little bit about resolving these contradictions. We're gonna reference Vladimir Lenin in one of his books called What Is to Be Done. I wanna take this opportunity while we're waiting for Bryant to return to mention a great short, it's really short, it's a short story, it's more of a parable. It's by Leo Tolstoy, maybe familiar with some of his other works. And it's called How Much Land Does a Man Need? So you're nodding, maybe you're familiar with the work. It's a really great little story. Basically, this Russian man makes a deal with the devil to acquire more land. And I think I find myself and my partner when we're driving around through different parts of the country and we ask each other, how much land does a man need? My God, why do you have all of this part of Montana? Why does this belong to you? How much do you need? And so the title of Lenin's book that we're going to talk about on the next slide is What Is to Be Done? That's another phrase I just like to throw out from time to time. What is to be done, right? I mean, and Lenin clearly had his own ideas. And again, that's a conversation for another day. But I want to talk about now how to resolve contradictions. So how can we change social conditions in order to resolve these contradictions that we've talked about, right? So some reminders, bosses need to pay their workers as little as possible. Workers need to make as much as possible. And the system needs workers to spend as much as possible. Commodities are produced solely for their exchange values. Profit motives do not include sustainability or environmental impact. And capitalism requires expansion constantly to fuel itself. So what are some other thoughts here? And there's a word I'm gonna drop that I want you to think about, and that's democracy. What does that mean to you? How does that influence ways that we might resolve contradictions? And I'm gonna pick on because he was gone for a little bit. I wanna know what he thinks. Yeah, I know you missed some of this stuff, but when you think about the question, how can we change our social conditions in order to resolve contradictions?
Honestly, I feel like you kind of set up where you're trying to go. You're kind of leading it. I think you need to socialize a lot of these items, and it kind of leads you to the end route. Yeah?
Yeah, I was going to say similarly, just decentralizing who has control. Like right now, things are held in such a small, narrow number of hands, and like giving workers and the general populace more control democratizes and makes that more equitable.
I think you're right. Giving workers more control. There's a quote I wanted to kick us off with, and it totally slipped my mind. Who's familiar with Noam Chomsky? Maybe you've heard the name, maybe you've heard him speak. Great, glad that's everybody. I was just watching this interview, it was from 2003, where Chomsky's asked about socialism. And he basically starts off by saying that word has become so devoid of meaning over the last century because of the inherent contradictions in the way that it's been presented. The two major propaganda powers of the world, the United States and the Soviet Union, or the West, right? And the United States is a proxy for the West. Both used that term to describe what was happening in the Soviet Union because it met their ends, right? From the Soviets' perspective, they used that term to appeal to the global population, the world population, who knew about socialism. They wanted to tie their political system to that, even though it was not socialistic. The workers did not have power, right? They didn't actually control things. The political apparatus did, right? And so I wish I had my laptop handy. I would pull out and better reference the rest of the material on this, and maybe I can share it out later, but... the West obviously wanted to present socialism as this evil system, this bad system that is the cause of all the problems that the people in the Soviet Union were facing, which obviously both of those had propaganda needs that they were serving. And that's why those messages were presented in the way that they were. But socialism, its core tenet is the workers are in control of the means of production, right? And we can argue or debate about whether or not the Soviet Union actually was designed in that way. I would argue that, especially under Stalin, it wasn't. And that really shifted things throughout the rest of the 20th century. But when we talk about what is to be done, Sawyer touched on this, and I want you all to take this home and remember it and reflect on this. It's that the workers need to be in control, right? Right now, it's the owners who are in charge. The owners have all the power. The money powers, the banks, the CEOs, the Jeff Bezoses, the Elon Musks, the Donald Trumps, he's a fucking moron, but he's not actually in control of anything. But those are the people, right, who are in control of the system. Those are the ones who control not only politics and the economics, but the social circumstances too, right? And it's because it's a direct result of the workers not having the power. And so what is one way? Can somebody offer me one way? This is really easy. It's not meant to be a difficult question. One way that workers can better control their power. Yeah, Brad. Do you
unionize your workplace.
That's the one I was looking for. Yep. Unionize your workplace. That's right.
Any other thoughts?
I just had a question about the Soviets, because I actually don't know a whole lot about their political and economic structure. If the power was not in the hands of their workers, was it in the hands of their political apparatus, or was that communism? Or was it a weird mixture of stuff?
Yeah, Brian, why don't you hand it?
So, in a lot of Western propaganda, communism and socialism get conflated and, you know, said to be synonyms. Communism, as it is, like, philosophically, is sort of an ideal situation that we're, you know, that communists are trying to approach. Like, the end goal is a society without distinctions of class, where everyone is equal, there's no oppression, there's no exploitation, there's no money or, like, orders or anything like that. Kind of like that first slide where everyone's dancing around a circle and everyone's happy. That's not something that's really been achieved, at least according to my opinion. What you do have are some states, like the Soviet Union, People's Republic of China, Vietnam, etc., that have communist parties that ascribe to those communist goals or ideals, and they run the country, or at least they try to, in a socialist way. And socialism, as we understand it, is the process of achieving communism, or at least achieving worker power, worker control of the economy, the government, and then it will, in theory, transition to a communist state or a communist way of doing things when there's a sufficient socialist power around the world.
Yeah, to put it succinctly, like, if you're familiar with Marx's theory of history and economics, you basically have feudalism, right? And then it goes to capitalism. And then from capitalism comes socialism and then communism, right? So socialism is a step on the path towards communism. And I want to add that Lenin, Vladimir Trotsky, or Leon Trotsky, Vladimir Lenin, thank you. They had their own conceptions, their own ideas. Mao had his own conceptions as well, based on Marxist theory, right? So you'll hear the term Leninist Marxist or Marxist Leninist. And what that means is Lenin's interpretation of Marx and Lenin's application of Marx. One of the key components to kind of tie this together, and I do want to be mindful of our time, is Lenin and the Soviets, or the Bolsheviks, believed firmly that there needed to be a vanguard party to lead their society towards communism. And the existence, I would argue personally, the existence of a vanguard party by nature, right, puts some people in power over others. And that is the exploitation that the Soviet system was susceptible to, which then gave way to the Stalinist purges of the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, right?
And I would say it's important to remember that there's multiple socialist experiments that have, you know, happened during the 20th century especially, some more successful than others, some stuck to their ideals better than others, some had better theory and practice than others, and, you know, none of them are perfect, and we can also kind of look at what are the successes, what are the failures, and learn from all of those. That's our goal, yeah.
Exactly, well said. All right, class, power, and ownership, right? So socialism, as we've talked about, is power to the working class, or what's known as the proletariat, right? This is one of those, like, seven dirty words you can't say on TV, is proletariat. Bourgeoisie is another one. And that's power to the capitalist class, right? And so that falls in the right column here under capitalism. Socialism, also social ownership of the means of production. That means workers are in control of the means of production. Decisions are made democratically by all people in a workplace or a country. Prosperity is shared among everyone versus capitalism. That's private ownership of the means of production. That means decisions are made by a small group of wealthy business owners, politicians, oftentimes called shareholders or the board. And wealth is concentrated among a few. So, Brad, you referenced earlier on, I think, the 1%, right? That's a really apt description of who is in control. Not only are they in control of the wealth, but they're also in control of the means of production. what is the means of production, right?
One more thing. Can you go back one slide?
Yeah.
One thing I want to add, I think we have this in maybe a later slide, but I just wanted to say this now. When wealth is concentrated among a few, we have, you know, think of, we think we live in a democracy. Who is actually in control? Who are the politicians? What is their net worth? Also think of your workplace. Is your workplace a democracy? Do you get to vote and make decisions? You know, that's all. We'll go on to more later.
I do think that pops up, but Bryant is on the right. He's absolutely right about that.
Yeah, sorry if I'm being a little ADHD here, so.
Yeah. So, means of production. That is all physical elements, apart from people, that go into producing goods and services. What are some examples of this? And these can be like really rote or like really simple. I mean, I think the most common examples that I think of are like 19th century examples. Like,
any thoughts?
A tractor. Sorry, I just stole one. Yeah.
I was just going to say like a warehouse full of machinery.
Yeah, perfect.
Textiles.
Perfect. You know, another example of the existing, I'm sorry.
We got some examples.
Oh, do we? Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, classical example, a factory with smokestacks, you know, turning out widgets, but also, like, a store, a farm, the tools that you might use at your job. Maybe it's not a hammer and wrench or whatever. Maybe it's a computer or what have you. Infrastructure, like roads and power lines, and then just the raw materials that goes into making those goods.
Yeah. You could potentially include things, software.
Yep.
Right. I mean, as we move towards a much more digital, technologically advanced age, those are some of the things. This is just a fun picture.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is like, how do we go about taking control of these means of production?
And the Communist Manifesto is a really short read. It's really succinct. I encourage you to find it online or pick up a copy from some place that you feel is a reputable seller of material that is written. And read it. It's an accessible read. If you haven't read it, it's a good introduction to Marx's theory of economics.
So I can take this one. So this is an example of how capitalism works and, you know, what we can, how we can think about this. So think of a sweatshop, maybe in Bangladesh, where they're making t-shirts. It costs them $5 to make each t-shirt, including the overhead, the material, the labor, the machines, everything. And then they print a cool design on it and sell it in America for $19.95. So where does that $14.95 go? That's profit to the owners of the factory, the people, the investors in the business. But really, it's unpaid wages to the workers. Like, we could, if the bosses weren't around, if the people owned the factory that they worked in, if they controlled the means of production, they could divvy up that profit amongst each other, or maybe lower the price of the t-shirts so that more people could buy them.
Right. I think that's a perfectly apt example, Brian, yeah. Right? So that $14.95 right now goes into what is essentially a black hole, right? I mean, it goes to a small group of people that did what? To produce the shirt. Nothing. They didn't do anything. They just own the means of production. And therefore, they're compensated for that at an alarmingly large rate. Right? So to Brian's point, that money could be shared among the workers. That money could be used to lower the cost of the good or the service. And so there are a lot of ways that you could better decide, more democratically decide to use the profits of any business.
So expanding on what we had earlier, so how we use surplus value is decided by the public in a socialist organization or a country, by the community, by the employees, or we could, you know, decide that there's no surplus value and everything just sells at cost. Let's see, whereas in capitalism with private ownership of the means of production, it's decided by the CEOs, the shareholders, the board, whatever. Let's see. So with socialism, we have feedback mechanisms, democratic, hopefully, some kind of maybe central planning or at least some planning for the future. We think of like the 5-year plans of the Soviet Union. had or that China has now. But then again, like what I was saying earlier, currently with a capitalist system, you spend a majority of your time, 40 hours plus a week, in effectively a dictatorship where your boss controls what you do.
I'm going to jump in here, Brad, because I think that is such a key point. When we talk about, and you know, earlier I planted the seed, right? Democracy, what does democracy mean in terms of these, in terms of this conversation, right? Much of your life is spent in dictatorships and private spaces. Brad, I would argue for you and I, the state employees, the situation is a little bit different. Our workplaces are actually much more, by their nature, democratized, right? But if you work for Starbucks, if you work for McDonald's, if you work for Boeing, if you work for anybody else, any private enterprise, your life is spent in a dictatorship. And what a disconnect, right? I want you to think about the American dream, the American, all the propaganda that we talk about in this country, right? It's a democracy. This election is about democracy, guys. Remember that. Don't forget. But go to work in the morning and better not miss it, because your boss, the dictator, will fire you and destroy your ability to provide for yourself or for your family if you don't, right? So there's a significant disconnect between what our political system says is just and right and good for us and then how we spend our working lives.
Yeah, and I'll just note also that, you know, even if you do work in the public sector, a lot of private industry has an effect on you. Like, your wages are probably, you know, industry standard, you know, compared to private sector stuff. And then also, you know, capitalism is also chasing quarterly profits. It's not doing a lot of long-term planning. So, like, I don't know how many times at your work you've been told by your boss, oh, we can't afford, the board didn't approve the budget to get that machine, but it did approve, you know, a private jet for the CEO or a retreat for the executives to go do team building exercises in
Maui.
Yeah, exactly. So stuff like that.
And then I just want to add too, right, so these bottom, the contrasting vision of socialism is that the focus is on planning for the future, economic and social equality, human rights. I would take this moment to plug a book called The Ministry for the Future. Some of you may have heard of it, some of you may have read it, by Kim Stanley Robinson. It's great, it's a good vision of what the world might look like if we organized ourselves around the idea of fighting climate change. So it's not specifically socialistic, it's not specifically fits into this conversation, but I want you to think about the ways in which you might envision society to be different and to be socialized, to be democratized.
I can take this one if you want.
Yeah, please.
So a lot of times we've been talking about private property, and a lot of people think that means my house, my toothbrush, my car, my record collection, what have you. So with Marxism, we make a distinction between personal property, that's the stuff that belongs to you and you just have as everyday things, and private property, which is the means of production, the things that wealthy people use to make money, their business, their farm, their factory, what have you. So if there's a communist revolution tomorrow, socialist revolution, we're not going to come and steal your toothbrush and say that it belongs to the state.
Well, Brian won't, but I might.
Okay, yeah.
No,
right.
Just kidding. No, seriously, though, he's absolutely right, right? It's not that your toothbrush now belongs to the state or that your car now belongs to the state or anything like that, right?
Yeah, maybe if you have, like, 37 cars like Jay Leno or whatever, you know.
Yeah, then maybe some of your cars belong to the state.
Right? Yeah.
And I think this when, you know, when I was flipping through the deck and I saw this image, I thought this was perfect. Like, this could be anywhere in the world, right? I mean, if I had to guess, I would say this is probably in Brazil. Just given the stark differences. But there's no reason, right? I mean, this line here is entirely arbitrary, right? There's no reason that these people need to have, I mean, look, are these hot tubs on every balcony? That's insane. It's a tennis court, there's a big pool, and these people live on functionally on top of each other, right? And there's no reason that this couldn't be a much more equitable situation for everyone involved.
One other thing I'll point out about this picture is that they have somehow commodified having access to greenery and trees and nature itself. So in this situation, if you're too poor, you don't even get to sit underneath the tree.
Right.
You get nothing.
Yeah, functionally nothing. I mean,
there's a, I can't remember off the top of my head, but there's a really good Marx quote about commodifying nature and turning it into dead commodities that is relevant to that. Adam, how are we on time? Do we have a hard out at 3 or?
5:04
Oh, okay. Well, so we got plenty of time.
We do have a little. Okay, great.
All right. Cool. Sorry if we were rushing then.
Yeah, we were being really mindful.
Okay, so we'll take a little longer on this one. So how do you, how does unionization, how do unions affect local politics? You know, how does, or how does local politics affect unions? Any thoughts on that?
Well, I would say a lot of times you'll see politicians and like business owners meeting and having, discussing what their goals are and what they want the businesses to grow to. But if you had more unionization, you would have the politicians actually meeting with their constituents rather than the business owners of their constituents.
Yeah, in the back.
Yeah, I was just going to say, another thing is just like it makes them, to just follow up on your point there, is it makes the politicians more accountable to the whole community, because at least for pro-labor specific policies, not regarding other policies, but you know, all the union members, they also, you know, they have the churches they go to, they have their families, they have the schools and everyone that knows them. So even if, you know, you only increase unionization by like 10%, you know, that 10% is vastly connected to the community who can also become more pro-labor.
Yeah, really well said. Any other thoughts on unionization and its effect on local politics?
I'll just say that, you know, unionization is great, but it's not the end-all be-all. It's not going to, if every business was unionized, if every person was in a union, it wouldn't necessarily lead to a socialist revolution tomorrow.
I want to take a quick moment on this slide, too, to talk about Butte, Montana, or what is was once known as Butte, America. If you're not familiar with Butte, it is a small town. It was a mining community that grew up in the 19th century and the early 20th century. And it was a hotbed for labor activity and union activity. A lot of the people who went there were immigrants, some of whom were coming from parts of Europe that had a deep socialist history or deep socialist movements at the time. And the unionization affected that community so much that it had a lot of power. Copper was the primary resource they were mining. And at one point it was said that Butte powered America because of all the copper that was being extracted from the hills. In the 1980s, with Reagan, the primary company that owned the mines at the time, this company called Anaconda Mining, moved out of Butte. They moved to Chile because the labor was cheaper, and it effectively killed the town.
Bryant here with a quick edit. I just wanted to point out something I forgot at the time. The reason why labor was so cheap in Chile in the early 80s is because they had just had a military dictatorship take over and topple the left-wing government of Salvador Allende in a coup that was basically directly controlled by the CIA and funded by them as well. So, yeah, look that up. Interesting story of what could have been. I'll get back to the main content now. Bye.
And I was just in Butte a couple of weeks ago on my way up to Missoula, and I was both impressed with the city. It's a really interesting place. But in Butte, there's this, it's called the Berkeley Pit. And it's a pit that they were mining in, and they were using pumps to keep groundwater out of the pit. It was 10,000 miles of tunnels in Butte from all the century plus of mining. In 1982, when Anaconda left, they shut off the pumps, and the pit filled in with water. It's now all the way full, basically, and that water is so toxic. It has a pH level of vinegar. Nothing can survive in it except for microorganisms. It is putrid, it's actually really like kind of a frightening image. That is a direct on effect of capitalism in America, a thing that it had done to a community that powered the nation at one point, right? And it was directly impacted by unionization. You know, it was a union town, and it had been for a century, and the union had enough power to allow the people to have a decent living. Now, listen, I don't really want to live in Butte, Montana. I don't imagine a lot of people did at the time, but there was jobs. People could afford to live there. It has a deep history, and the local politics were effectively run by unions. And when the political situation changed on a national scale, the company felt, through the neoliberalism policies, through globalization, through all the other things that we've kind of talked about earlier on today, it allowed them to leave and to effectively kill this town. I mean, its population and the industry there today is nothing compared to what it is. It's what it was. It's so many vacant, rundown homes that no one has lived in decades.
That reminds me of an example. There's a very similar mine near Tucson, Arizona. I think technically it's in Green Valley, another copper mine. And, you know, there's also almond farms nearby. Mm-hmm. And between the two of them, they suck up a huge amount of water. I think it's from the Gila River. Mm-hmm. That the local Native American reservation basically gets no water. So we can think of also like ideas of colonialization, that happened with capitalism. So like if we were organizing things based off of like who actually needs the water, like do people really need to eat almonds that much? Like does it really make sense to suck this river dry to make copper and almonds, or could we do that somewhere else? But it's profitable in Arizona, probably because of the local...
Local laws,
yeah, local political establishment. Yeah.
Any thoughts, comments, questions, concerns about any of that? I mean, you should all be concerned about it, but that's not here nor there. All right, let's press on. Okay, how can or how does local Colorado politics impact international issues? A good example of this, I think it's on everybody's mind, is Israel and Palestine.
Well, if you ask our local elected officials, they would tell us adamantly that Colorado has nothing to do with international issues and we should just shut up and go away. Mm-hmm. But in reality, there are many, many different military facilities that build parts for airplanes and bombs and weapons. And I mean, we have military bases here training soldiers.
Ball arena.
Yeah, exactly. Most of them subsidized with our tax dollars,
mm-hmm.
In some capacity. So that's one example.
Yeah, that's a great example. Any others?
I'll add to that. So like, I think a lot of you have heard probably of the Cop City in Atlanta, where basically they're taking a city park and turning it into a training ground for police. And there's been a lot of activism locally and around the country to stop that. There are similar plans to build police training areas in Colorado and other states. And a lot of those police departments have deals with the Israeli military to do training. So, Israeli police or military officers will come to the U.S. and train officers here, or vice versa, the American cops will go to occupied Palestine to learn how they do sort of counterinsurgency and occupation there. So that is kind of an example of how international politics are coming to Colorado, to the U.S.
Yeah, I would add another example is refugees, right? I mean, we receive refugees from all over the world. There's a major influx from Afghanistan in recent years and a major influx from Ukraine. I'll let you guess as to why that might be. They come here and they settle here. They settle all across America, but they settle in our community as well. And our local politics are impacted by those international issues as well, right? I mean, these people need a place to live. They need a job. They need community support. I mean, many of them don't speak the language and need assistance learning the language, right? And so, our resources are used in those ways or can be used in those ways to improve the situation for those refugees and for those immigrants who have chosen or have been chosen to settle in Denver and in the Colorado area. Any other thoughts on this before we move forward?
Another example would be Colorado's anti-BDS laws.
Bingo, great one. Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Madeline, yeah. Anybody not familiar with BDS, what that means? It's not like BDSM, although it could be, I guess. Thank you for being brave. Thank you, the B is for brave. No, the B is for boycott, and the D is for divestment, and S is for sanctions. So a quick history. A BDS movement effectively toppled the South African government, right? So if you're familiar with South African apartheid, there was a global BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against South Africa. It basically crippled their government. It enabled, they couldn't do anything. And so there are calls to do a BDS movement, and there are people who engage in BDS, including DSA and some others, against the state of Israel for its ongoing genocide in Gaza.
And to add to that, I think the U.S. government propped up the apartheid South Africa government for many years after it probably would have fallen, because they were an ally against communism. And on the other side, Angola, I believe,
was
fighting for their independence, Cuba sent troops and aid to help in that fight.
I'm gonna steal your thunder, Brian.
Yeah, no, go for it.
Because it's a great example. Cuba sent troops to Angola to help Angola fight against South Africa, and the psychological effects from the white South African, what are called Afrikaners, losing military battles against a mixed Cuban and Angolan race, right? Like a mixed opposition.
Yeah,
a psychological battle.
I think they gave they especially recruited Afro-Cubans volunteers to go fight there because of this.
It shattered their notion of white supremacy. It literally broke them. They were like, we were told that we were Übermensch, that we were the best, we were the great men, and that we were, that they felt no fear. They can't stop us because we're white. We're so much better than them. We're innately better. And then they got their asses kicked, and they had that changed the way that they viewed it. I mean, it was a really serious, as not to be undermined, the psychological impacts of that on white supremacy in South Africa.
Yeah, and also a peacetime example, you know, Cuba sends doctors around the world. They have a very good medical training system there for such a small country. They send doctors around the world to help with COVID, with other diseases. Yeah.
I'd also just like to bring it back to BDS. There are, I think, 37 or 36 U.S. states that have some sort of law prohibiting some BDS activities. And it can be as extreme as in Texas. If you're a public school teacher, you will have to sign a piece of paper saying, I will not criticize the Israeli government in any sort of capacity. Or it can be as, there's actually a BDS law here in Colorado that was passed in 2016. Ours is a little bit less insidious, I guess, but it basically says that companies that are invested in by the state pension fund, Jeremy and I's retirement funds, companies that are invested in by that fund cannot basically participate in any sort of action against the Israeli government, or they get de-invested from by our state pension fund. And some of the companies that are invested on that fund include Woodward, which is one of the companies that built bombs for the Israeli government. So,
Yeah, thanks. Now I want to shout out for bringing up that law. I think that it's incredibly important to think about that, right? Because when you vote in a local Colorado election, you know, you should be cognizant of what are the issues that my candidates, that I'm choosing to vote for, what do they believe in, right? What do they want to see? All right, this is a great one. Brian, why don't you take us?
So we talked about this a little bit, and we'll go into more depth on some of these in a later lesson, but so there's all these isms around. We went over a little bit of the difference between communism and socialism, but there's many different flavors of socialism, Marxism, what have you. I won't go into all of these, but I will say we have social democracy crossed out. That is what often gets called socialism by, I guess, well-meaning liberals. This is basically like strong welfare state. This is like what you have in Northern Europe, like Germany, Norway, Sweden, Netherlands, where you have a social safety net. You have maybe some laws where, like, maybe a small percentage of workers have to be on the board of a company where there's a lot of union density, a lot of union participation, or union power, but there is still a capitalist mode of production. There is still a lot of wealthy people in the upper echelons of government. I think some of those countries are still even technically monarchies, so not really living up to the socialist ideal. Any questions about any of these isms before we move on? We're not gonna go into all of them, but if you have a specific question. Oh, also, before I forget, market socialism is crossed off. That was sort of the idea that they had in Yugoslavia. Didn't go so well for them for a number of reasons. A lot of that had to do with NATO and the US. But it had a lot of those same contradictions of capitalism, but with sort of a state behind it. And I'll shut up because I haven't studied that in depth, but that's my understanding of it. Any thoughts, any questions before we move on?
I'm just curious, what is sewer socialism?
Okay. Thanks. So that was, I believe, in Milwaukee in the early 20th century. There were some socialists that got elected to office, and they were building infrastructure like sewers, because during that time, a lot of cities had open sewers that were spreading disease. So they really wanted to help with public health. They built a lot of sewers, schools. And then their detractors sort of called them sewer socialists as like an epithet, as a derogatory term, as an insult. But they kind of took it on as a badge of honor also. It's like, yeah, we built sewers. We helped people not get sick from
public health, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Love it. And I want to take a brief moment to share some thoughts that I had when I was looking through this slide this morning. And it's, the left has a lot of political nuance, right? We've talked about some of it today. We mentioned Marxism and Marxist-Leninism and, all the various, Bryant just mentioned like some of the Northern European systems, and they sort of have a socialist or social democracy nature to them, right? Like, the left has lots of political nuance. Socialism, the foundational economic idea for leftist politics, can and does take many shapes, as you can see. The right is not bereft of nuance, but its nuances are just much more narrow and is generally, although not always, reactionary. And therefore the right will shift and does shift over time. Think of slavery. Right? I mean, there were conservatives, small c conservatives, people who wanted to maintain that system, right? And they shifted away from it as leftist movements basically forced them to and pushed them away from it, right? Conservatism, small c, is only as good, or in other words, just, as that which it seeks to conserve, to paraphrase Friedrich Hayek. And in the future, this is where you may feel some contention about this, but in the future, there may well be, and in fact, I think that there will be, right-wing socialists, right? If we think of them as that constant shifting, it's entirely possible and realistic to assume that in a future socialistic society, that there will be those beholden to or attached to the systems and principles that they are most comfortable and familiar with, right?
I can speak to that. Like, I know in some countries, like especially Russia, there is a pretty strong communist party. I think it's the number two party as far as membership in the country. But like, they have a lot of socially backward ideas, conservative ideas about like LGBTQ rights, that kind of thing. So like, and then also I will say communism is what, socialist thinkers have imagined as the ideal. But maybe once we get to that, or even if we get further along the road of socialism, we might think of an even better system that makes more sense for people at that time in the future.
And, you know, when we talk about the two-party system, we're so limited in that conception. You know, it's easy for my parents, who are conservative people, to be like, well, you're voting for the libs because you're a leftist. And I'm like, actually, I have really deeply serious criticisms of the Democratic Party. I would much rather see a very, like, an array of leftist parties of which I could choose from. You know, that conception is hard, I think, for a lot of Americans because we are so inundated. We're so used to this two-party system. And I want to really quickly ask the room, too, who here can tell me, I know Bryant can because we already spoke about it, but who can tell me why we use the terms right and left in politics? What is the origin or genesis of that term? Are any of you familiar? Yeah, in the back.
Wasn't during the French Revolution the Jacobinists sat on the left side of the French Parliament and the conservatives sat on the right side.
Bingo. That's it. It all comes down to the French Revolution, a specter haunting Europe, that haunted Europe all the way until 1917. That's exactly it. It's the Girondins, the Mountain, the Jacobin, those were the political parties that arose during the French Revolution. They sat on the left side of this gymnasium, and the royalists sat on the right, and that is how you got the conception. I in some ways think, man, if only the Jacobins had chosen the right, maybe things would be very different now, right? I mean, it's just, who knows? Who's to say, right?
You had something also about the origin of the word reactionary?
Yes, reactionary. Yeah, right-wing politics generally.
Yeah, so I mean, that you'll hear that thrown out sort of as an insult by socialists against the right wing. And that basically means people that were reacting against the French Revolution at the time and saying, you know, no, we don't want any part of this. So I think the modern meaning is like someone who doesn't really have an ideal that they're
They don't
shooting.
Have a theory that they're proposing.
They don't have theory. They don't have an ideal that they're looking for as a
end to their means.
Exactly. But they're just saying, I don't like this. Get it out of here.
Yeah. I think, you know, and again, I use the term generally, but I really do and truly believe right-wing politics mostly are reactionary, even in today's day and age, because look at the Republicans here in America, right? They don't have a healthcare policy. They don't have one. They want to appeal the Affordable Care Act for why? They have no conception. They have nothing to offer.
Yeah, they're just saying that's woke, that's, you know, DEI or whatever.
Right. It's just purely reaction. So, something to keep in mind. Your right-wing friends may be bereft of political theory.
Someone else have something? I would just say one more thing to add to that is the Democrats are also definitely reactionary. But they're also on the right as well, so.
Totally, absolutely. I don't want to give them a pass.
And if you want to be even more confusing, both the Democrats and the Republicans are liberal by the French Revolution definition because they're not monarchists.
Yeah. Political history is a really fun ride. I encourage you to do it. Tread lightly. All right, so Socialism 102 teaser. And I think, Bryant, you know more about this than I do. But
Not necessarily.
Okay, good. We're on the same page. This is in development. I want you to all... I would encourage you when we roll this out to come back. I hope you enjoyed hearing us kind of ad-lib today. But some things that we want to talk about potentially, right? Dialectical materialism. You may have heard of this before. It sounds really scary and kind of weird. You're like, what the fuck is that? It basically boils down to a philosophy, and we'll get into that and we can talk about that. An explanation of isms, some of the isms that you saw on the last slide, including differences. That's a great example. Anarchism versus communism. I mean, a lot of people are like, what is an anarchist? And you just don't want anything. And like, I don't know what that means. But anarchism is like, again, kind of like neoliberal. Anarchism is a really defined thing. And it means something. And it's important to understand that if you're going to wade into those waters and maybe debate or start to unpack the differences between that and communism. Timeline and a brief history of socialism. That sounds like a lot of fun. Personally, I'm into that. Intersectionality. So I think on the last slide, we had something around like eco-socialism and feminist socialism. Intersectionality is the, in my opinion, is the crux of the 21st century's movement. As we move forward, if you consider yourself to be anti-imperialist, then you are engaged in intersectional politics in some way, some form, some fashion. And we can talk more about that in the future. Base and superstructure. I'm not fully sure what that means.
Yeah, I don't know myself either. So Ben C. put most of this together, and I helped a little bit. And so we are still coming up with a script for, or a slideshow or whatever, for 102. So that is not done yet. And so the base and superstructure is like a philosophical concept that I'm not going to try it. Never mind.
Okay. We'll unpack that when we learn about it.
Exactly.
Share what we do.
Yes, it does come from dialectical materialism, I believe. So okay. Do you have a definition? Or it's...
Great.
And then we'll go into some more of the major socialist organizations that exist in the U.S., what they believe, maybe some of the different factions of DSA. I don't know if factions is the correct word. Caucuses.
I think it's close enough. And if there are things that you want to learn about, that you want to hear Brian's and I go on about, I mean, I think he and I are both happy to talk till we're blue in the face, please let us know. Message us on Slack, hit up the Paul Ed chat, and just say, hey guys, can you talk to me more about X? I have no idea. Not X.
Not Twitter,
Please, no. I don't want to talk about that. Great segue from Brian. Other socialist organizations, some to be aware of, PSL. I know they operate here in Denver, too. We've collaborated with them a bunch. If you're not aware or familiar with them, make sure.
Yeah, I believe they're a Marxist-Leninist organization. Communist Party USA, lean a little bit more liberal. Denver Communists are Trotskyists, and I think they are associated with the now-defunct Socialist Alternative. I know there's other organizations that maybe have taken the place of that. I don't know if Socialist Rifle Association is still around.
I'm not sure. You know, I know that they were... You're nodding. Raising your hand. Yeah, let's hear it. There they are. Okay, good. I know that they were operating in the South, too. John Brown Gun Club. If you're not familiar with John Brown, educate yourselves, or if you want to learn about him, let us know. We'd be happy to talk about him. Really fascinating dude. One of the major causes of the Civil War. Freedom Road Socialist Organization, Working Families Party.
So I don't think Working Families Party is explicitly socialist, but there are a lot of socialists in that organization.
Yeah, and then, you know, obviously the last call out here, not the Democratic Party. To be really, really clear, if you watched the DNC last week at all, you know, if you've caught any of the clips, you've probably seen that there were a bunch of folks who were either removed or harassed for representing Palestine or advocating for Palestinian speakers. You know, the Democratic Party, in my personal opinion, is an unfortunate ally. That's an ally is a very generous term to use for them. So that's my opinion. Suggested reading. Oh my God.
Yeah, so I put together most of this list. So on the left are more contemporary and more entry-level books. ABCs of Socialism, you can find a free PDF on the Jacobin website. And that's sort of just an introduction to a lot of the concepts that we've discussed. It doesn't go into huge depth on any of them, but it is a good introduction.
Highly recommend.
Yep. People's History of the U.S. is just, you know, a good explanation of American imperialism. Bullshit Jobs, there's a full-length book, but the one I have there is the shorter article.
Yeah, and anything by David Graeber is incredible. Yeah. He's sadly missed. R.I.P.
But that short article, you might have to find it on like an archive.org kind of thing, but it's worth reading. Shock Doctrine, again, American imperialism and neoliberalism, privatization. If you want to get angry at George Bush and Dick Cheney, that's a good way to do it.
If you're not already.
Yeah. People's Republic of Walmart, that's sort of a modern, advocacy for the idea of central planning, basically saying that big firms like Walmart basically act like a centrally planned economy.
Yeah, it's like a centrally planned microeconomy for its business, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
So.
On the right, do you want to keep going through those?
Yeah, no, I mean, so these are just some of the classics. Communist Manifesto, as we said, it's a quick read. I think it's like, I don't know, like 10 pages or something like that?
Yeah, it's like not very long. 50,
that sounds right. Okay, well, I was off. Conquest of Bread by Kropotkin is sort of the seminal anarchist text about mutual aid and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You have some more on that?
I was just going to say, Kropotkin's great. He's got another book called Mutual Aid. Anarcho-communist thought leader at the time. He was alive at like the beginning of the 20th century, in the late 19th century. Conquest of Bread is great. It really puts out the message about feeding each other and feeding your community and how important that is. And when you conceptualize any social movement, how do you feed people? That's a big question.
And October by Chani Miéville is just a history of the October Revolution, the Russian Revolution. It goes into more in-depth, you know, before and after, of course. And then The State and Revolution by Lenin is what he wrote in the middle of that revolution as sort of his outline of, you know, how did we get here? What are we doing? What do we want the result to look like? And some good arguments for that. He would have been great on Twitter. Like, he just insults all his enemies.
Major shitposter energy.
Exactly.
Marx,
yeah.
Too, actually.
Yeah.
Really good. Anyway.
And then What Is to Be Done is something that he wrote earlier, sort of outlining his vision. I think around 1905, when they had the failed revolution.
The first revolution. And then Michael Parenti is a great American thinker. Also, sadly missed, Black Shirts and Reds.
He's still alive. He's no longer working.
I thought he was.
Yeah, I believe he has dementia, but he's still alive.
Okay,
last I heard.
Good.
But yeah, he goes into more defending what he calls actually existing socialism. So the socialist states that have existed and do exist. He maybe goes a little bit harder than some here might agree with in defending them. But it's a good read, and it, you know, really, I think that one was written in the 80s. So it's in the context of Reaganism and that whole neoliberal turn that kind of started in the late 70s.
And I would add to, you know, reach out to Brian Sarai or Adam or Ben or any of the other folks on Paulette if you're like, you know, these were great, or maybe I read some and I'm like, now I'm hungry and looking for something else. I think that we're a really knowledgeable group, and we've got a big library, so there's always more to read than just what we're recommending. And I also want to segue that into other media podcasts. If you don't listen to them already, are fucking incredible, man. It's free. You can listen to just about anything. I said earlier today, you can listen to like 150 hours of free content on just about anything. There's a lot of great stuff. I think the one that I listen to on this, or the two that I do, is Economic Update with Richard Wolff. Comes out like once a week. It's like 30 minutes. It's a pretty quick hit. He's a great intellectual, really breaks it down in a good way.
He's a big advocate of unions and also worker-owned co-ops,
yep.
Which we'll probably go into later in another lesson.
Yep. And then the other one that I dig is The Dig with Daniel Denver. I'm actually surprised too, and Brian, I want to maybe add one, and that's Jacobin Radio on podcast two. Behind the News with Doug Henwood is a really good program that's included there. So there are a lot of great resources, and if you want to share more about these podcasts and YouTube.
Yeah, so Yellow Parenti is just Michael Parenti lectures that have been recorded at various times, and they're in a podcast feed. Revolutions, Mike Duncan is sort of a liberal, but he does a very good history of the Russian Revolution.
The Haitian Revolution,
exactly.
The French Revolution. If you want to learn history, and if you're specifically interested in revolutions, I've met Mike Duncan. He's fucking incredible. This podcast like changed my life. It's really, really good. I cannot recommend it more. And if you're like, French Revolution is like a big scary topic and I don't know where to start, start with his podcast on it. I also recommend the Haitian Revolution that he talks about. The Mexican Revolution is really, really good. If you're like, what are the Zapatistas? You know, what is Chiapas? I don't know what's going on down there. That's a good one too.
And then the last one that was Trillbillies, that's just kind of a fun, goofy podcast. They do have guests on, and they do talk about serious things. They're two guys from Kentucky and one from Atlanta, I believe. So they cover more of the like rural South, or in the, you know, urban South, of course. Yeah. And then, let's see. Yeah, good stuff on YouTube. Second thought. Let's see. Of course, just look up Michael Parenti lectures. There's a bunch of them on YouTube. One of them has a yellow tint. That's why it's called Yellow Parenti, because their camera technology wasn't the greatest in the 80s.
Funny.
Breakthrough News, good source of news. They were at the DNC covering that whole thing. Bad Empanada, I will say I disagree with him on a lot of things, but he's good on some stuff. And then Non-Compete doesn't put out stuff as often. They're anarchists, I believe, but they have some good explanations of capitalism and that sort of thing. And then Empire Files, Abby Martin is the front woman on that. She does really good coverage of Palestine and other things to do with American imperialism.
Yeah. So if you're not familiar with Ursula K. Le Guin, she was a science fiction writer. She's a Taoist. She, one of her last speeches gave this quote: "We live in capitalism. Its power seems inescapable. So too did the divine rights of kings. Any human power can be resisted and changed by human beings." And I just think that goes hard. I would tattoo that on my forehead. I'm not that brave, unfortunately, but she was. And I think that that is so, so true, and a perfect way to close out our presentation on Socialism 101.
Yeah, I'll just say, if you want to read any book by her, I'd say The Dispossessed is a really good exploration of sort of an anarcho-communist society. The subtitle is an ambiguous utopia or something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. So it's sort of like showing the good and the bad of what that system could be. Even if it's like the ideal that we have today, maybe it's not what it would be in the future for the people actually living in it.
Yeah.
So,
really good.
And of course, you know, connect with us if you want to learn more, if you want to get involved. If you're not on Slack, let us know and we'll help you get connected on that. I don't think we're doing every other week right now. I think we're...
It's monthly, right?
Yeah, we're slowing down to monthly for the time being, but...
And our chair is Adam. He's sitting in his chair. Just wanted to say that.
I think that's all we have, but if we have any thoughts, we have a little bit of extra time before we need to...
I was just going to say, obviously, unionizing is not going to overthrow capitalism, but if you are interested in unionizing your workplace, the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, which is a subsidiary of DSA that was created a few years ago, they do a free, basically, how to unionize your workplace. It's like 4 Zoom classes over the course of a month. They have a book if you don't want to do that. It's great training. I've taken it. Highly recommend if you're interested in unionizing.
Good plug.
And to that, I will say I've talked to some of those folks. They have people who are basically on call that have organized their workplaces that can give you pointers. They have labor law lawyers that can connect you with if your employer is doing some shady stuff. And I will say also, you know, Denver DSA has plenty of other committees and working groups that, you know, are working on different aspects of socialism. So we have a labor committee. We have a feminist committee. I forget what it's called. Yeah, we have all internationalism working groups, so that's dealing with a lot of stuff around Palestine right now, but other things as well.
Yeah, and I don't want to belabor this point, but you know, if you are like, what should I do next? What should I read, listen to, or watch next? Let us know. You know, talk to us about it. It does depend on you. It's what you're interested in. But I really, really, really highly encourage you all to pick up a new book, to pick up a new podcast, to go to YouTube and watch one of those channels that we've plugged and continue to educate yourself. We live in an incredible time where we have access to education that folks, you know, 100 years ago could only dream of. And I think that is truly something that we should take advantage of. Cool.
Thanks for coming, everyone.
Thanks, guys. Oh, a round of applause, my God. Too kind.